Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
And coming up tomorrow on The Brian Lehrer Show, Lady Gaga versus Beyonce versus Adele. This is not a celebrity segment. It'll be Sasha Frere Jones from The New Yorker on the cultural meaning of these three pop idols compared to each other and those who've come before. That's coming up tomorrow here on The Brian Lehrer Show, maybe with me, or maybe we will give this voice box a day off. We'll see. But the Supreme Court is in the home stretch of this term, releasing their final opinions this coming Monday. This morning, a bunch of decisions came down, including one protecting data mining by corporations. They ruled that data mining qualifies as free speech, and we'll explain data mining if you don't know it. So we'll talk about that, as well as some of the big Supreme Court decisions from this whole term and what they tell us about the direction of the court and the country. Jeffrey Rosen, law professor at George Washington University and the legal affairs editor of The New Republic. And Jamie Floyd, legal analyst and blogger at itsafreecountry.org. Join me now. Welcome back, guys.
Hello.
Good to be back.
Jamie, you too?
Yes, hello.
Okay. For a moment, I thought you sounded like me. I can't say, what are you doing tomorrow morning? The biggest one that came out this morning was Sorrell versus IMS. It was 6-3 with Breyer, Ginsburg, and Kagan dissenting. This is the case about whether data mining by companies qualifies as free speech. Jeffrey, what was the decision?
A very interesting and important decision. So this is a Vermont law which prevented data miners from selling prescription information to pharmaceutical companies. And basically, you go to the drugstore, and the drugstore wants to release information about how many drugs are prescribed, give that back to physicians, data mine it, which makes make predictions about who's buying what, and then market to the doctors so they can push one kind of drug rather than another. And Vermont was outraged by this. They thought it was a violation of medical privacy, and they passed this law preventing the disclosure for data mining purposes. The court overturns the law in a 6-3 decision, a very interesting vote. The five conservatives were joined by Justice Sotomayor, who agreed that the First Amendment prevents privacy from trumping free speech. Some people will say that this is another example of the court using the First Amendment to bolster the rights of big business at the expense of Americans, as Senator Leahy did in response to the decision. But here, unlike the Citizens United case, Justice Sotomayor agreed with the conservatives. Their basic free speech concern was that marketing was the only purpose for which the disclosure wasn't allowed, and they said that that was discriminatory. There was a very powerful dissent by Justice Stephen Breyer, who generally is deferential to regulation and free speech cases. He was joined by Ginsburg and Kagan, and Breyer said this is not discriminatory at all. The commercial speech gets less protection than core political speech, and there should have been more deference to the privacy interests. It's terribly interesting because, of course, data mining is one of the great privacy issues of the day at a time when people are wondering whether Facebook can run face recognition analysis and things like that. The question whether if you disclose intimate information to one party, they can disclose that for another purpose, including data mining, is sort of the central privacy commission in a digital age. And if the First Amendment continues to bar efforts to protect privacy, then privacy may really have an uphill battle in the future.
So free speech versus privacy. You mentioned Sotomayor going over to the what's considered usually the more conservative block on the court. And Justice Alito, though he's generally a conservative, he joined the majority opinion here, but he has a record of often defending privacy over free speech almost to the extreme. He was the lone dissenter in the 8-1 decision protecting the hateful speech of Westboro Baptist Church at military funerals, right?
That's absolutely right. Alito, in some surprising ways, has emerged as the privacy cop of the court. And my friends in the privacy community, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, for example, are writing all these briefs where they're citing Justice Alito's youthful thesis, the one that he wrote at Princeton, where he said that data privacy was imperiled. They're kind of subtly working in these sycophantic references. But Alito has bought it hook, line, and sinker. As you said, in the military privacy case, Alito was the only vote for saying that grossly offensive speech could be restricted in the interest of protecting the privacy of the family that was having the funeral. And there was another 8-to-1 decision last year involving these very graphic crush videos where animals are sort of tortured. And once again, that was an 8-to-1 decision, Alito alone dissenting on the grounds that traditional notions of dignity and privacy could trump over free speech. That did not rule the day for him in this case, where he sided with free speech over privacy. And here it was just the liberals who were standing up for the privacy interest. But generally, the obvious trend we're seeing is a tremendous consensus that free speech wins in case after case. I think lots of people expect that on Monday, when the court should end its term, they're going to strike down California's ban on violent video games, again, with the idea that free speech is more important than traditional values like privacy.
So, Jamie, we learn about Alito, maybe through this decision and his history, that his pro-business slant trumps his pro-privacy slant. Should we look at it that way?
Well, perhaps. It is interesting. Of course, these justices are, many of them, relatively new to the court, and justices evolve over time. And as Jeffrey points out, especially in today's decision, we're entering the brave new world of data and privacy, which is different than the more traditional cases like the Snyder-Westboro Baptist case, which I think was perhaps one of the most significant cases of the term, and the case that has yet to come down, what is known as the violent video case, Brown versus Entertainment Merchants case, which will come down at the end of the term. Those are more traditional First Amendment cases and much easier for Alito to have thought about along the way, whereas he may evolve more in the brave new world context of privacy, data, Facebook, internet, etc.
And Jeffrey, there are even more cases this term as we look at the big sweep of what has happened from last October to now that can be framed in terms of privacy versus free speech. So is this your sort of conceptual headline for this term of the United States Supreme Court?
I think so. And there are important other cases. There was that NSA versus Nelson case where the question was whether intrusive background checks for federal contractors who worked at an academic lab were could be restricted. And these people said checking on their youthful drug use, if they wanted to be subcontractors on an airplane military contract, was a violation of their privacy.
Was it NASA or the NSA?
It was NASA, forgive me.
Yeah.
NASA, the NSA would raise privacy questions of its own.
It was
NASA. They were building something like spaceships or something like that. And the court said that there was no violation of data privacy here. Interestingly, though, several justices, including Alito, I think a majority of justices, said there might in the future be some constitutional right of informational privacy. They didn't foreclose that possibility, unlike Scalia and Thomas, who said that they would never accept such a right. And that is a ray of hope for privacy people who think at some point the question of how much data that you disclose to one person can be disclosed to another might be restricted by the Constitution is central. Because after all, in Europe, the central privacy right says information disclosed for one purpose can't be shared for another without the consent of the individual concerned. We have no global privacy law like that. And without some sympathy from the Supreme Court as opposed to First Amendment hostility, as we saw today, then that sort of right may be very hard to protect.
That was one of the many cases, Brian, on which Kagan recused herself. Of course, we'll see less of that over time. But again, another young justice who will perhaps evolve over time, but we have less of an idea about where she stands on issues because, of course, she has less of a record, but also this term, less opportunity to participate.
Do you want to say anything else, Jamie, about Sotomayor joining the mostly conservative bloc on this privacy versus data mining corporate free speech decision?
Well, which came down just an hour or so ago. You know, it is a fascinating, not much more to say except that it is fascinating the way that case broke down with Kennedy delivering the opinion, and then you have Roberts, Scalia, and Thomas and Alito all on the Kennedy opinion. That is not at all surprising. And then you read the name Sotomayor, and it is a bit shocking to see her there standing with them. But as scholars of the court know, you know, anyone who follows the court at all, sometimes things do break down that way. This opinion was somewhat divided, but not along purely ideological
right.
grounds. And I think it's because, as Jeffrey suggested, this is a new area, essentially, of law. Even though at first it looks like a traditional First Amendment case, they really are dipping their toe into what will begin to be a new area.
So, Jamie Floyd, Kennedy wrote the decision for this, and
it's
I wonder
yeah.
if you can reflect it all. I mean, some people say Justice Kennedy is the most powerful man in America on a court that's divided 5-4 in so many cases, and he is sort of the swing vote. The court ruled last month that the overcrowded prisons in California
right.
violated the Eighth Amendment ban on cruel and unusual punishment. They ordered the state to reduce its prison population by
right.
more than 30,000 inmates. That was huge. That was a 5-4 decision along ideological lines.
And he wrote that opinion.
And he fell on the liberal side in that case.
Yeah.
So is Justice Kennedy making his mark in any coherent way over this term as the swing voter with so much power?
Well, he certainly stepped, in my humble opinion, into the role that O'Connor previously had. And he's, I think, making a clear legacy in certain areas of law. And as you point out, he did, I think, another very significant opinion, the California prisons case, holding that overcrowding in California prisons was the primary cause of a continuing pattern of violation of prisoners' constitutional rights to adequate health care, and essentially mandating that California limit remedy that problem by limiting the overcrowding. So they have to reduce the prison population in California. It's quite extraordinary when you think about it. And we have Alito dissenting, joined by Roberts. So this is a much more classic ideological split, with Kennedy, as you say, leading the majority in that opinion. So I do think he is establishing himself as the key swing voter, and I think everyone sees that. But I also, and I'm curious what Jeffrey thinks about this, I think the chief is starting to emerge as a strong chief, and we're beginning to see more decisions coming down. There was some concern about that initially, and more unanimous decisions, although we do have a lot of close splits, but increasingly we are seeing some unanimous decisions. And perhaps behind the scenes there at the court, there is the stronger and stronger hand of a very conservative Chief Justice. I'm not sure whether Jeffrey would agree with that.
Jeffrey Rosen.
I do think so. The unanimity rate is extremely interesting, and it, of course, we don't have the absolute latest figures, but as of June 3rd, according to SCOTUS blog, only 12% of the cases were 5-4, and 51% of them were unanimous.
Mm.
I've just got all the past terms. These stats are interesting. In 05, Roberts' first term as Chief Justice, 12% of the decisions were 5-4. The next term, 06, it leapt up to 33%. That was one of the most divisive terms in recent memory. The justices were sniping at each other over affirmative action and partial birth abortion and campaign finance. The 5-4 rate fell to 17% in 07. It was 18% last year. So basically, I agree, Jamie, that we're seeing, he came in, remember, promising to have more unanimity and collegiality. It didn't seem to be panning out at the beginning, especially around 06. But this term, there are fewer high-profile culture war decisions. The only remaining one is violent video games, which is likely to be a bipartisan majority. So I definitely agree. We're seeing more business cases and fewer of these culture war cases, and that leads to more unanimity.
In other words, this might be an indication of more not necessarily of more ideological confluence on the court, rather that this term didn't include tons of super controversial cases.
It's true, although let's not forget that even the slightly below the radar screen ones can create ideological divides that are hugely important. The biggest one that came down today was yet another pro-business case. It was called Pleva versus Mensing, and the question was, this was the drug Reglan, which treats digestive tract problems. It malfunctioned, and someone won a big state jury verdict because the claim was that they hadn't warned about the dangers of this drug enough. The manufacturer countersued and said the fact that the Federal Drug Administration regulated Reglan Raglan meant that the state jury verdict had to be overturned. It's a technical field called federal preemption, but it's hugely important. And 5-4, the five conservatives against the four liberals, the court agreed that the state jury verdict was preempted, meaning that the victim of this bad labeling was completely out of luck. And we have seen in these other preemption and pro-business cases, Roberts is very interested in them. The court has been taking more and more pro-business cases, and there we sometimes do see those old ideological divides coming up.
And Jeffrey, we talked before about Sotomayor crossing the usual ideological line on the data mining case today, but there's another decision that came down this morning that I think is going to be less in the headlines, but I know you wanted to talk about it, a so-called preemption and confrontation clause decision. Stay with us, folks. This isn't actually going to be that wonky. But here, talk about rare moments, Scalia joined the liberals. What was that about?
He did. It's really interesting. And this one is not so technical. The basic question is whether the Sixth Amendment, which gives all accused people in all criminal prosecutions the right to be confronted with the witnesses against them, does that require that when the state introduces a forensic report involving your blood alcohol concentration, do you have to have a chance to confront the analyst who prepared the report, or is it enough just to read the report itself? And 5-4, as you said, with Scalia joining the liberals, the court says, no, you need to physically be able to confront the analyst. And Scalia is absolutely fierce on the question of the Confrontation Clause. He is a big pro-civil liberties person. And on this question in particular, it's the area of law where he's proudest of joining the liberals. And he just says in case after case, all cases means all cases. You have to have the right to confront. And he doesn't want to make any exceptions for pragmatic reasons. And there we have the more pro-prosecution justices, the other conservatives who are dissenting. So I think this was a nice reminder of the fact that at least in some criminal procedure cases, Scalia actually can be true to his text and history principles.
Yeah, and it's very consistent with his very strict reading of the Constitution, Brian. He says you have a right to confront, as the language of the Sixth Amendment says, the witnesses against you, and that's that. Read the Constitution. We need to go no further.
And we've been talking about this pro-business slant of the court. Certainly, we talked earlier this week about the Walmart case where women as a class did not have the right to sue for sex discrimination. But what about the Microsoft case, Jamie? This was about patents, and you could say the little guy won here.
Well, this is a very important case because this is what I thought was one of the few hot potatoes left on the Supreme Court plate, if you will. And it sounds, again, it's another one that sounds wonky, but it really isn't. This was a Microsoft appeal from a $290 million jury verdict for patent infringement. A little Canadian software firm was arguing that Microsoft had infringed on their patent. So I guess anyone can relate to that story, you know, if you don't get too bogged down in the technical details. And really what it had to do with is the regulation. Who is going to regulate the validity of patents? Is it going to be the Patent and Trademark Office? Is it going to be, do you have to go back to them every 5 minutes, essentially, and ask that your patent remain valid so the big guys can't come in and steal your good idea? And so the case really matters, Brian, to anyone who has a good idea and wants to protect it. And in the end, believe it or not, for all those who think the U.S. Supreme Court always sides with the big business, they said no. If you have a good idea, really, and you've patented it and you've done everything right, the good idea remains yours for the duration. And that's essentially what the ruling is.
So on Monday, Jamie, we will get, I guess, two remaining decisions, maybe some smaller ones, too.
Yeah,
I don't know. But two that people are waiting for are this one on violent video games that we referenced before, whether California can ban them in any way, and campaign finance. What's the campaign finance issue this time?
I want to say one thing about violent video games. That's a case that proves once again that, just because a case is argued early doesn't mean it's going to come down right away, because they argued that case back in November, Brian. That case goes all the way back to November.
And so why do they release that one on June 27th as they go on vacation?
Well, no, don't worry, Brian.
They're going to play video games.
They're not going to do that to you. I think, Jeffrey, I don't know if you agree. I think, you know, I think more about the inner workings of the court than I do, because I've only covered it from the outside. But I think it has to do with when they get together to conference it, how many times the opinion has to circulate amongst the judges, whether it had to be reassigned. Yeah. It all has to do with internal politics.
So it means they might be more divided on that or no, Jeffrey?
Well, if it were unanimous, it might well have come down earlier. But it means that there's enough. Maybe there's horse trading or change votes or something like that. But yeah, it might be a surprising lineup. Absolutely.
And the campaign finance issue is.
Take it away, Jamie.
Oh, I'm sorry. On the campaign finance issue, I'm afraid I'm not as up on that one.
So we will find out on Monday. And so, last thought in our last minute, the Supreme Court watchers we talked to. You know, besides you, have been telling us that this term is terrible and they're just waiting for next term when the really juicy stuff is taken up, like immigration and health care reform.
Terrible in what way, Brian?
Well, small potatoes. Boring.
Bad for Supreme Court watchers, good for the country.
Yes, I mean, I haven't found it boring, personally.
No.
But bigger fish to fry next year, Jeffrey?
Yes, I mean, many people expect health care reform to be next year. And, of course, there's a chance, although it no longer seems as likely, that gay marriage could be even heard at the same time. My dream Supreme Court term would be to see in the same term Justice Anthony Kennedy voting both to strike down health care reform and to recognize a right to gay marriage, both on the same grounds that there's a liberty presumes an autonomy itself.
And,
I'm just keeping my fingers crossed for that one.
Jeffrey Rosen, George Washington University law professor, Jamie Floyd, legal analyst, blogger for itsafreecountry.org and other things. Thank you both very, very much.
Thank you. Pleasure. Have a good weekend.
And listeners, thanks for all the remedy ideas. Keep them coming to #SaveBrian's Voice, and maybe I'll make it to work tomorrow.